This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. Did Washington State University know Brian Koberger was a dangerous threat? Were there fiery red flags of alarm that they chose to ignore? Would he have been kicked out and home to mommy and daddy in the Poconos and these murders would never have happened if Washington State University had acted? This, as photos of the killer's bleak apartment are revealed. What clues did he leave behind? And believe it or not, witnesses are getting death threats as the victim's families in anguish, as vile images of their children in death are being released. O-H-E-L-L-N-O. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us.
911 location of your emergency.
Hi, something is happening. Something happened in our house. We don't know what.
Scream, and she ran upstairs because she saw someone. That's what I'm pretty sure she said. Someone's here, and she screamed and just ran downstairs.
Did you kill and murder Madison Mogan, Kaylee Gonsalves, Zanna Kernodle, Ethan Chapin?
Yes.
At this hour, family members still holding out hope that the feds will swoop in and seek the death penalty on Brian Koberger. Is it possible? And what about the fact that he was leaving a trail a mile wide? Red flags of alarm to Washington State University that Brian Koberger was a danger. Well, listen to what the Gonsalves family has to say. I find it really interesting that Washington State had this long history of his anti-woman misogynist stalking behavior and did nothing. That's really interesting. If he had been thrown out, he wouldn't have even been there.
Exactly.
Yep. He should have been thrown out before he ever killed these kids. That's the truth. If they should have set a standard and said, look, we don't put up with this in our university. You cross the line, you're done. It's not even our decision. It's just your behavior. We're holding you accountable. You should behave like this. That's the expectations in Washington State University. And you either do it or you don't.
I can always tell when he's having a bad day, and he looked probably the worst I've ever seen him. And he just kind of stared at me, and there was a newspaper sitting on the bar, and he just kind of picked it up. And I was like, it was him.
He was really desperate for attention and ways to control people.
That last sound from our friends over at Crime Fix, where coworkers, when they heard about the killings, they're like, it's Koberger. It's got to be Brian Koberger. With me, an all-star panel of guests to make sense of what we know right now. But first, to Susan Hendricks, investigative journalist that shot to fame in her coverage of the Delphi murders, author of Down the Hill, My Descent into the Double Murder in Delphi, and was there for the sentencing, drinking in every move Koberger made, such as it was or was not. He seemed completely oblivious to all the pain around him, pain he had caused. But Susan Hendricks, let me get to the issue at hand. Washington State University, did you hear Mr. Gonsalves telling us that there had been 13 complaints where he would intimidate or stalk female students?
Absolutely, and that he almost or wanted to make them cry. That is what he did. He treated them completely different than the male students. It was sign after sign after sign to me. What did it take? And was that the final straw for him when he was finally let go? But you're right. Complaint after complaint, the Gonsalves family says.
Hey, you just told me something I didn't know, Susan Hendricks, that part of the intimidation tactics on Brian Koberger was to try and make the girls cry?
Yes, he seemed to enjoy
that. Well, I didn't know that.
Yes, would criticize the girls more, pin them out, pointed them out in class and would make them cry, it was a clear difference in that classroom. And they complained and finally was the final straw when he was let go. But absolutely, there were signs, and we keep hearing more and more
but
every day.
They did nothing. Dr. Bethany Marshall joining us in addition to Susan Hendricks. Dr. Bethany, renowned psychoanalyst out of L.A., author of Deal Breakers. You can see her now on Peacock, and you can find her at drbethanymarshall.com. Dr. Bethany, that sounds like a fifth grade, no, not even a fifth grade, a first grade boy. Kiss the girls and make them cry. A grown man getting his PhD. One instance Mr. Gonsalves told me about, no, it was Mrs. Gonsalves told me about, Christy, that he would stand in the doorway where the students were trying to get into the classroom, all bowed up, and the girls would have to, like, edge by him, and their bodies, their front of their bodies, you know what that entails, would have to brush up against him. That's gross. And then Susan Hendricks telling us that he would intentionally make the girl students cry.
Nancy, this doesn't surprise me at all, because the defining feature of psychopaths is that sexuality, cruelty, and sadism are all commingled. They all go together in some way. So making the girls cry was probably sexually exciting for him.
Bethany, okay. You know, even if you wear hip boots when you walk through the cesspool, you're still going to track a little home on the living room carpet. Do you ever get so saturated you track a little bit home? Because do you hear what you're saying? That Koberger would get sexually aroused? Oh, I don't even think about that. Over seeing girls tear up and get upset, and how does that connect to what he did to the victims?
Well, yeah, so what I'm saying is that seeing them cry is like looking in their eyes and seeing pain of some sort. And when you think about what he might have been doing to make them cry, he was probably gathering personal information and pushing their buttons. And that I'm saying this is associated with sexual arousal. So these poor women, he probably had an erection while he was doing this. And how it relates to the murders is that the murders were really overkill. They were sadistically motivated. And if we think of him stalking the women, the university women, as kind of like foreplay before he got to the major crime, which was stabbing these students multiple times. So it's like he was graduating towards increasingly sadistic acts in order to maintain his sexual excitement. That's what we have to see. So had he not
hey,
been
Bethany.
Incarcerated? Yes.
Bethany. Wait till you hear this. Christy, Mrs. Gonsalves, and husband Steve Gonsalves are telling me about how many complaints he had. Now, remember, Dr. Bethany, he had just gotten to Pullman, Washington State University. And by Thanksgiving, they say that there were already, that they know of, 13 formal complaints by women against him. What is that? September, October? And part of November in 2.5 months. What I'm saying is Washington State apparently did nothing. They finally had meetings and discussions and blah, 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 and decided they were going to let him go. But they released him just out into the wilderness.
Nancy.
Listen to what they said, okay. Dr. Bethany.
I mean, he had 13 in the first semester. The first one came in August. That's the first month that you come to school. And then 12 after. And November had a huge, Thanksgiving break. And then he didn't even go the whole month of December. He took off like December 9th or 10th. And there's 13 formal complaints. Act aggressive and stand in doorways from what we've read. And the girls would have to like walk past him and like,
Ugh. Joining me is Joseph Scott Morgan. Not only death investigator with literally thousands of death scenes under his belt. He is a star of a hit new series, Body Bags with Joe Scott Morgan, author of Blood Beneath My Feet on Amazon. But for purposes of this discussion, Joe Scott is also professor of forensics at Jacksonville State University. Don't you guys have rules? I mean, I know Jacksonville State University does, but How many complaints do there have to be? There's 13 formal complaints, we've been told, by the Gonsalveses. How many more were they that were just like comments, you know? Just comments like, what is wrong with him? Going to complain to another faculty member or a guidance counselor. What in the world? Can you imagine a grown man enjoying seeing his girl students start crying and they just let it happen, according to reports?
At Jack State, he would have been out on his ear. This is my 21st year as a college professor, Nancy. And I got to tell you, I'm thinking about this in a different way now that this conversation has come out, and I'm got my professor hat on right now. I think that his motivation for being in an academic environment is so that he can perpetrate upon these defenseless kids in this environment. He is Lord and Master in this environment. He can control the classroom. He can do whatever he wants to. He can do that dead-eyed stare at people. And he is not in any way an educator. Look, when kids come into my class and they're learning about forensics, I don't want it to sound like a kumbaya moment because it's not. I want them to come in so that they can learn, so that they can go forth and be effective practitioners in the field. That's not the environment that he has created. Nancy, if I were to compare him to something, I would say this. If you know how a snapping turtle works, they sit on the bottom of the water, their mouth is open, and you know what? Their tongue comes out and it looks like a worm. So anything that comes by, that fish is going to attack that worm, and then they clamp down. That's what he is. That's this behavior. And he was utilizing the university in this environment to look for victims. And I think he probably would have continued as well.
You're going to have to tell me the tongue and the worm part again. What?
Yeah, a snapping turtle will sit on the bottom of a lake bed or on the bottom of a river bottom, and they will sit there and they'll open their mouth and their tongue looks like a worm. It'll come out and just kind of sit in the water like this. So if a fish comes by, they'll see it, they'll strike at it. And when they do, the snapping turtle clasps down his jaws on them. And there's your meal. I've always felt like he was a reptile anyway. This further confirms it to me as a professor.
I mean, there has to be rules that are followed.
There has to
be. I'm just thinking about what Dr. Bethany is saying about basically scaring the girls and making them cry and enjoying it. And according to the Gonsalveses, this was a pattern of behavior. If they had kicked him out, as I think they should have, he would have turned tail. You'd see nothing but tail hole and elbows, him running home to mommy and daddy. But no, he stayed and ended up murdering the four students. And there's more. Listen to Keely Gonsalves' father react.
Guy should have been punched in the face. He was a creep, man. He's a disgusting creep. The kind of guy, we even heard about it from the Seven Sirens bar where those girls put a little note and said, hey, if you get this credit card, watch out for this guy. I mean, he's been doing this his whole life. And we didn't stand up to him. And we need to start standing up to these type of bullies. And hopefully Idaho will get it right. Hopefully those prisoners in there, they'll do the real justice. They'll act like real men in there, and they'll handle it the way that it should be handled in the first place.
Are you surprised, Dr. Bethany Marshall? He wasn't just terrorizing the female students at school. A lot of them, 13 formal complaints that we know of. How many other complaints were there that were not formal? But now we know it was discussed at bars and restaurants where the female waitresses were like, watch out for this guy. He is a creep. Stay away from him. So he couldn't contain himself.
He was compulsive, Nancy, and he could not stop himself. Again, if we think of sex, aggression, making women cry, dominating women, threatening and intimidating them as all going hand in hand. We could say, in a sense, he was sexually compulsive, that he was constantly, constantly acting this out everywhere he went. And Nancy, if the criminology professors told the school administration that he was a danger, why wouldn't they trust criminology professors? I mean, these people are trained to spot sociopaths. And furthermore, did you know that Brian Koberger's school office was in the basement? It was it was isolated from other offices. And because of that, students were afraid of him and did not want to go in. So in a sense, they served up the students like a tasty little snack to him, which I think is just so disgusting. And it's really disturbing.
911 location of your emergency.
Hi, something is happening. Something happened. Can I help? We don't know what.
What is the address of the emergency?
1122.
What is the rest of the address?
Oh, Kings Road.
Okay. And is that a house or an apartment?
It's a house.
Can you repeat the address to make sure that I have it right?
I'll talk to you guys. We live at the lights, so we're next to them.
I need someone to repeat the address for verification.
The address, 1122 King Road.
So many stab wounds.
It's unbelievable.
And I heard someone in the bathroom, and I heard her crying, and I heard some guy say that you're going to be okay, I'm going to help you. And I kept calling her name, but she wasn't answering.
And I saw some man in their house outside.
He brutalized each and every one of them.
Does it never end for the victims' families? Well, short answer, no. Their suffering will never end. But now they have another fight on their hands, trying to stop vile images of their children in death being released. Can you imagine? I remember writing my first book, Objection, and I learned about what I call blood money, people trying to get crime scene photos. I remember specifically people trying to get Nicole Brown, O.J. Simpson's wife, autopsy photos. Yes, so they could sell them. That fight going on, I couldn't believe that there are ghouls out there doing that. The family fighting tooth and nail tonight to try to stop those images. But right now, I want to tell you about just obtained photos. And we are not here on Crime Stories. We are not posting photos, bloody photos of these children, these University of Idaho students. That is not happening here. I will show you weird photos of the killer, Brian Koberger's Pullman apartment, very bleak apartment, to determine what, if anything, we can learn. Listen.
New evidence photos show the bleak interior of Koberger's Pullman apartment and WSU office. Aside from graded papers, criminology textbooks, and a few birthday cards, Koberger's apartment is largely devoid of any personal items. Police marked a black glove, Koberger's computer tower, a few receipts, and a vacuum cleaner as evidence items, but found little of value in the sparse apartment. Koberger's nearly empty home echoes his thin social life. The admitted mass murderer had just 18 contacts saved in his cell phone and spoke to his parents for hours at a time every single day.
Oh my stars! Of course, Philip Dubay is going to join us in just a moment to tell me how this doesn't mean anything, but I guarantee you it would have meant something to a jury. Did you see his bleak apartment, Dr. Bethany Marshall? That means something. Even his food in his freezer. I remember a family was over, a friend of my daughter's family was over, and they're very, oh my goodness, okay, yeah, no, that's not happening in our house. And the family was over, and they were very strict on their diets and their children's diets. And one of the children asked for, I don't know, a juice box or something, and I opened up, we were all standing in the kitchen, of course. I opened up our fridge, and they literally physically reacted. They went, because the fridge is just crammed with leftovers and leftovers and blah. It's just, you have to dig in there. It's like an excavation to find something. Look at Koberger's fridge. I can hear Dubay in the background going, he wants to jump in so badly. What does it mean, Bethany? I mean, look in his fridge. There's nothing. There's not even a piece of lint on the floor. Oh, is that an apple he's got in a Ziploc bag on the right? What? You're not supposed to put apples in the fridge. That said, oh, tofu Yes, and everything is hermetically sealed, and it looks like that fridge was just cleaned out with some type of antibacterial spray. Hit me, Bethany.
Well, this, you know, the apples in the baggie are kind of an OCD type thing, right? Being afraid of germs. I like what the commentator said about a thin emotional life. When you think of the traits of the sociopath as having very shallow emotions, their lives are not rich like ours. They don't put photos around of family members. They don't collect memories of the people around them. They're not comforted by home. If you think of what we were talking about earlier about the fact that he has what we call a paraphilia. So a paraphilia is constant sexual arousal at something that is not sexual in nature, so anything other than sex, paired with attraction towards non-consenting adults. This is something that preoccupies Koberger. That's all he has room for. So it's not surprising to me when you look at his apartment that there's no sign of emotional richness, emotional life, relationships, anything other than crime. And the apples in the baggie, which are both just very compulsive. His whole life is organized around his compulsion, Nancy.
I don't know what you just said. You lost me at being sexually aroused by an item not in nature. Like, I don't know what that means.
No, except being a paraphilia is two things. It's being aroused by anything that is not sexual in nature, meaning it's, and also being aroused by a non-consenting adult. That means that he would not be aroused by a woman who loves him or wants to be with him. He would only be aroused by a woman who's non-consenting and doesn't want to be with him. In other words, he can't gain sexual excitement by anything other than being around people who really are not connected to him in any way. That's what we call a perversion. You cannot be excited by a full connection with another human being who loves you back. So it creates kind of a shallow perspective in life, and the apartment seems shallow. Like there's no life there.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. Joining me now, special guest Chris McDonough, director, Cold Case Foundation, former homicide detective with over 300. Oh, yes, speaking of OCD, check this out. Shoes lined up. He's staring up at the shelf to make sure. Oh, he's cleaning the creases in his shoe. From what? All that mud? No, from nothing. Chris McDonough, director, Cold Case Foundation, homicide detective, over 300 homicides under his belt. I found him on The Interview Room on YouTube. That's his show. Chris, when you look at this apartment, what I'm saying is, overarching theory here, there were red flags, fiery red flags being waved in front of everybody's face, okay? Nobody got it. Nobody did anything, including Washington State University. I'm calling you out, people. But are you surprised that there were no blood drops in his home? They got that vacuum cleaner, you know, to do what? To see if there was any trace of the victim's hair, any fibers, even dog fibers from Murphy the dog, dog hair from Murphy, anything they could find. Oh, no, that's not going to happen. What do you see? You're the trained homicide detective. When you look at his freaky clean apartment, it gives me the skeeve just looking at it.
You know, Nancy, what jumps out at me is the duality of his personality. If we look at the room as a whole, you can tell there's that OCD, you know, part of his personality. But then you go into his closet. Look inside of his closet to the left side. That is completely disheveled. All of the receipts, there you go. All of that tells us a whole other side of his personality. This tells us what the girls were seeing. This is the hidden side of his life, the secret life, as we call it. These are the complaints that we're seeing here, not physically, but this is his personality. It's all about
control in the public persona, and then behind the scenes, it's about violence. If you look at the book, there's one book there, The Ivory Tower on the Floor, in his, that was found inside of his chest of other items there. That is about sexual assault of college students. It's called Unsafe in the Ivory Tower. If we look closely at that book, right there to the far right in the bottom right corner, that book is about sexual assault about college students. Now, go do the math, right?
I'm doing it right now. I'm making a note of everything you say. You know what's really interesting, Chris McDonough, and this is an aside. This is how you prepare for trial. You get with somebody. I try to get with somebody that knows more than I do. So you can hear their ideas. See, I've looked at those books. I've looked at the titles. But you point out a book about sex assault in the Unsafe in the Ivory Tower, how female co-eds are sex assaulted. It's not just a coincidence. There is no coincidence in criminal law. These are all tutorials for Brian Koberger, but nobody put together the puzzle pieces, and now four students are dead. You know, Joe Scott Morgan, professor of forensics and forensic expert, Joe Scott, you've been to a million scenes, and I can't explain why, but when I would go to a crime scene, I would want to just sit down and have everybody get out of the room. Yep. So I could just sit there. And I don't know what I was looking for, but I needed it to be quiet. Mm-hmm. So I could just look and see what I could see and learn what I could learn and feel what I could feel in a crime scene like Koberger's bleak apartment. And what about that computer screen, Joe Scott? Remember how he, quote, helped his colleague put in her Wi-Fi security cams so yep. he could have access and watch her walk around her apartment naked or half naked or just sitting there watching TV or making out with her boyfriend. I don't know what he was watching. Can you imagine the hours he spent on that computer? Just look at the chair. Look at the stark position. I'm not a shrink, but this is telling me something. And look at the bed. One pillow. I guarantee you, he makes the bed up and at night just gets it on his side and leaves the rest made up and sleeps on the one little area. See how one side is a little messed up and the other side isn't? He just like sleeps in one spot by his computer. I mean, there's no way that anyone would have known all this, but we're learning all this in retrospect. Washington State knew a lot, but we're learning a lot, and none of it's good, Joe Scott.
No, it's not. And listen, yeah, I can't imagine. I don't want to imagine what he was viewing on that computer, particularly when you think about this observable, kind of track that he was on, where he goes into this woman's apartment and tells her that he's going to assist her with her security system. Lord only knows where that went. And sitting around, to me, Nancy, this speaks to me as this guy is mission oriented. His mission is to wreak total and complete havoc. You're showing the text here. I'm wondering where his forensics texts are as well, because for so long people had kind of pushed out this idea that he is this, and I took great exception to this, that because he's studying criminology, that he's a forensics expert, and those two things, you can't conflate those two things. But I would assume that he had texts relative to that as well to help him kind of work through this idea that I'm going to be this master criminal. He's not trying to edify himself by studying these texts in any way. He's using this as a means in order to understand what he needs to do in order to get to certain points along this journey of horror that he's on. For me personally, one of the things that I would really like to try to understand is not only what happened in Pullman, Washington. I truly hope with everything in my being that they're going back to DeSales, Nancy. that they're taking a long look at everything that he got involved in Pennsylvania and see if there is anything else out there that is very disturbing where he was interacting with people. I want to know if there's any cold cases around that proximity, because this is something he's been thinking about for a while. And to start off with four homicides, I just think that there's more to
it. Yeah, he went from 0 to 120 MPH overnight. Yeah. Hey, Sydney Sumner, Joe Scott just said something that jogged my memory. He says to, Koberger says to his female coworker, "Let me help you. I'm going to help you set up your Wi-Fi." So he could watch her naked or half naked or cooking or whatever she's doing in her place. Same words, an echo. "I'm going to help you." That's what he said to the murder victim before he butchered her. Another thing that you said earlier, Sydney Sumner, Crime Stories investigative reporter joining us, that he had a thin social life as evidenced by his devices. Explain.
Well, we've learned that Brian Koberger only had 18 contacts saved in his phone. I cannot imagine the 27-year-old when this first started, only having 18 people saved in your phone. And most of those contacts didn't even have names associated with them. That's what I found even more odd about this, that, oh, girl I went jogging with, another girl I went jogging with, red hair. So of the 18 contacts that he does have saved in his phone, many of those are extremely impersonal, somebody he maybe met once or twice. So it just goes to show that he was very socially inept. And speaking on the phone for hours with his parents every single day, there's evidence that he would call them and talk to them until he fell asleep every single day. And that is just, again, extremely odd for a 27-year-old in a PhD program.
Dr. Bethany Marshall, I need a shrink and I need one fast. Hit me.
Well, the fact that he didn't have their real names in the phone suggests that he was already trying to depersonalize potential victims, right? I said earlier, sexual attraction only to non-consenting adults. If they become real, then he has to relate to them. He just wants to have power over people. And aggression is such a core part of that personality. I bet he talked to his parents for hours because that was the only place he could even feel a semblance of an attachment, right? He probably didn't feel attached to anybody else.
Some kind of
a
comfort thing, Dr. Bethany, to keep the phone open and talk to your mom until you fall asleep. It's like sucking a bottle or holding on to your banky.
That's right. Yeah, having your little binky in your mouth. Exactly. And that computer in his room, I just can't stop looking at it and wondering what else is in there. Are there other pictures he took of non-consenting adults in public? Like, was he going into bathrooms and putting the mirror and the camera into the stall? Or, you know, I would be surprised if this perverse activity was just isolated to the one professor and to the students and to the people in the bars and restaurants. He had to have been doing it everywhere.
That's a scary thought. I wonder if bathrooms at these restaurants and where he worked have been checked for, you know, like the tiny cameras. They need to check. I don't know if they've thought of that yet. Okay, joining me now, veteran trial lawyer Philip Dubay, joining us out of the L.A. jurisdiction. Okay, Dubay, I guess now you're going to tell me that none of this amounts to a hill of beans, right?
Not even close. I mean, are you going to say that because he's living in an austere apartment as a starving student, basically not having a pot or a window is a foreshadow of a quadruple homicide? I mean, I look back at my own college days, and those days we had a beanbag chair and a lawn chair in our living room. Seriously, and to suggest that because he has a quote-unquote bag of apples, that it's a sign of loneliness or a sign of sexual fatigue or some other type
of
psychobabble.
Not what we said. Not at all what we said, Dubay. Look, you can do your legal analysis, your defense-related legal analysis through your lens, but at least get it straight. We were talking about the sparsity of items in his fridge and the way that things were organized neatly and the austerity of his apartment and the lack of any connection to anybody, another human. Did you see his mom and dad in a framed photo by his bed or a lot of pieces of paper and memories and ticket stubs and photos stuck to his wall with scotch tape? No. He's like a robot. He's a machine, a killing machine. And it means something. Whether you want to admit it or not, it means something.
The guy's on the spectrum. Don't you remember? He has Asperger's. You know what that is? It's a social awkwardness. He doesn't know how to relate to other people. He's alienated himself. Nobody wants to be around the guy, let alone give them their telephone number and address to be added as a contact to his phone. That is one of the symptoms of Asperger's. They don't have a social network or people in their orbit. So if you were to look at it from afar, yeah, compared to other healthy, able, working, assiduous college students, he stands out. But to suggest that this is all a symptom or a foreshadow of a quadruple homicide, that is psychobabble.
The families of Madison Mogan and Ethan Chapin are suing Moscow over the release of hundreds of crime scene photos and video of the first response to 1122 King Road. Their attorney claims many of the photos constitute an unwarranted invasion of privacy. Leander James says blurring on the images isn't effective, and blood is still visible on floors and walls in footage. Sounds of sobbing friends and roommates are incredibly traumatizing for the families. James argues the crime has been extremely sensationalized, and harrowing images have now been plastered across the internet, news channels, and social media, often for economic gain.
Straight out to Susan Hendricks, joining us, investigative journalist on the case. Okay, so now the family that's still dealing with the murder, the brutal murder of their children, are having to take on a fight so these vile photos are not released. Why would they be released? I mean, somebody files a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act. So what?
Exactly. Stacey Chapin, Ethan Chapin's mom, and also Maddie Mogan's family filed this and said it opens a wound. This is what Stacey said, that's not healed yet. In Delphi, Nancy, they were sealed. Sadly, there was a leak of the crime scene photos early on, but the autopsy sealed. Decision made by Judge Fran Golan. I think it should be made here, but there was a hearing on this, and the judge said that he will make a decision down the road. So I hope so. I mean, why do we have to see that exactly?
I mean, I get it that when a case, you're seeing some of the photos that have been released. We are not showing bloody photos of the victim's blood in the crime scene, the home on King Road. The families have been through enough. Not only that, now witnesses are being threatened, death threatened. Listen.
Judge Hippler weighing redaction. Attorneys say witnesses' names should remain private, as witnesses have been threatened and stalked, hiring private security and relocating from their homes. In particular, attorneys believe Koberger's alternate perpetrators should be kept from the public. Hippler asked for the information on each intended redaction, including their roles in the case and whether they have already been identified in the media.
Okay. Sydney Sumner, Crime Stories investigative reporter, also on the Koberger case. I take it that there have been a lot of threats on witnesses, but the witnesses that are getting the most serious threats are the ones the defense wanted to use as if some other dude did it, scapegoat, and they knew all along it wasn't true.
That is correct. Those are the witnesses that attorneys on both sides are most concerned about getting any kind of threat or having safety concerns with their names being made public. And the defense at this point has admitted that those people were never involved in this crime, and this was simply a defense. They were trying to point the finger elsewhere to say it was not Brian Koberger that committed this crime. So that has been disproven, but we know how many people support Brian Koberger. We saw the Reddit threads. We saw the Facebook groups trying to prove Brian Koberger's innocence. So they want to protect those people that were named in this alternate perpetrator theory and make sure their names are not leaked to the public so no one can do anything to put those men in harm's way.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. Dr. Bethany Marshall, the victims' families call them the, quote, pro-burgers that are still going online. I see it every time I dare to look at social media, that he was framed. They're actually death-threatening witnesses, especially threats going to the some other dude did it scapegoat the defense came up with, knowing full well Koberger committed the murders. They were going to blame somebody else in open court, and it leaked out. And now the scapegoats are getting threats. What is wrong with these people?
Do you know 3-5% of the general population has the same personality disorder that Koberger has? So it's not surprising to me that he has this huge following. Koberger probably did what his minions or followers wish they could have done themselves. They just don't have the courage to do it, Nancy. So he's their king. They are pro-Burger, and they probably are harassing anybody who they feel is going to bring the king down. That's just what's happening here.
And you know, Joe Scott Morgan, professor of forensics, I can't stress enough the brutality of the crime scene photos. They're worse than any so-called slice and dice video you've ever seen, except they're real. And to re-victimize these victims that endured a horrible death that night and their families, I mean, I can't convey the nature of these photos, Joe Scott.
It's very difficult to do that. Nancy, reflect back just for a moment. Do you remember being in pretrial as a prosecutor, and when we still had the old, you know, format images, and they would be spread out all over the table, and you're trying to decide what you're going to use in order to describe what happened? All right. And some of these images in our circumstances, you and I, over those years ago, you think, do I really need to show this to the jury to get the point across? Because we would have to use our discernment in order to do that. Because some of these things are so over the top, Nancy, I can't express this enough to the viewing public. Why do you need to see them? Outside of court, this thing has been adjudicated at this point in time. There is no value in this. No one is edified by this at all. And families are being destroyed. They're being traumatized. They're having to live through this over and over and over again. People don't understand. You know, you could just be one of these parents, and you could be in a store, and someone would have seen this on the internet, and they'll say, I can't believe what happened to your child. I actually saw the image. Just let that sink in just for a second.
I can tell you one thing, Joe Scott, before I would introduce brutal photos like this, I would absolutely clear the courtroom and warn the victims' families.
Brian Koberger wasn't always skinny, as surviving roommate Dylan Mortensen said in her description of the mass perp. Koberger was quite plump before losing 130 pounds just in time for his 16th birthday. Koberger bragged about the weight loss in a job application, claiming his dedication to running and boxing qualified him for the part-time security job at a school in his hometown's Pleasant Valley district.
Again, Dr. Bethany Marshall, I don't know what it means, but it means something. Brian Koberger, obese, then goes on a crash diet. A crash, oh my goodness, yes, okay. A crash diet. It means something. I don't know if it was to lure women. What does it mean? The body image, how does that factor into this?
Well, antisocial personality disorder, which is used interchangeably with sociopathy and psychopathy, it causes impulsivity and dysregulation, meaning the people cannot control all of their emotions, overwhelm them. So somebody who's dysregulated and impulsive is just going to eat anything that's not nailed down. Okay. So he probably had to go into this total starvation mode, vegan, vegetarian mode, to get the weight off so he could predate on women. I mean, you're right. He had to look great to lure women. And what was his one of his first jobs? It was as a security guard, a position of power. He was already graduating to the next thing, which would be working in an academic environment where he would have access to women and could study criminology. So it had a dual purpose, access to women, and at the same time, he was learning and preparing for the upcoming crime.
You know, Chris McDonough, I'm thinking through all of these red flags. The bleak apartment, the lack of contacts, the objectification of women he would put as a contact, red hair. I'm trying to take it all in. But one of the most disturbing is that Washington State University knew. They knew there was a big problem. When they heard about the murders, they went, it's Koberger. They knew. But they let him stay. If they had fired him long before, maybe these murders would not have happened.
Yeah, that's a great point, Nancy. I mean, what did they know, right? Did they? They obviously had a PhD, piled higher and deeper on complaints about Brian Koberger. And also, if we look back into his apartment for a minute, you know, and this is his office here, you know, it's just such a bleak personality. But look at the birthday card to the left. It's Teddy Roosevelt on a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And there's a comment on that that says, this is basically your egos and your personality. You know, carry a big stick, but make sure, you know, you eat them, i.e. right there, both of your egos. This is a whole other lane for Doc to tell us about. But this really is Brian Koberger, and other people saw it. And WSU most definitely saw it.
Okay, Dubé, what do you make of the Freedom of Information Act to release these brutal photos? The judge has taken it under advisement. I don't see there's any way that you can redact out all of that gore.
No. And first of all, I don't even know who would want it. I mean, seriously, I mean, what type of pornography would the petitioner be into?
Freaks.
Yeah, gorecore is what I call it. But make no mistake about it that just because somebody files a petition to make these photos public doesn't mean the court's just going to grant that petition. It's subject to a balancing test where court has to balance the public interest in disclosure against the privacy interests of the next of kin. And if you have a situation where you can prevent trauma, preserve dignity, and prevent further distribution of this type of carnage, the court can deny it. There's no automatic right to this material. And frankly, I could see somebody who's into this type of imagery further disseminating it on the black market somewhere, maybe to share in this type of gorecore or to even profit from it. Who in their right mind would even want this stuff?
Yeah, blood money. Blood money, Dubé. You ask, who is it? Probably nobody that you associate with. It's probably the same people that wanted Nicole Brown's autopsy photos. Them. Those people. And they do make money off of it. You know what? For once, Dubé, for once, I pray that you are right. And the two judges involved in this matter will hear your voice tonight, Dubé, as we all join the victims' families and ask the judges, please do not release these photos, these images, this audio, where you can hear crying and see what happened to the victims. Please don't do this to their families. Don't say, the law compels. The law does not compel. Dubé was right. You are responsible for the release of these photos, Judge. It's on you. As we wait for justice to unfold, we remember an American hero, Officer Darren Burks, Dallas PD, survived by his grieving mother, Cherie. American hero, Officer Darren Burks. Rest in peace, officer. Nancy Grace signing off. Goodbye, friend. This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.